Hi, it's Michael Sinoff with Michael Sinoff's HardToFindSeminars.com. Here's an incredible interview. The title is called How to Find a Fortune in Other People's Junk. When most people think about the junk business, they picture huge lots full of rusty cars, assorted parts, and expensive machinery. And that's a fairly accurate picture of a thriving, serious junk scrap business. But there are also little guys out there making it off what other people throw away as a side or main business, with or without property to put their stuff on. And they're not experts on parts, metal, or antiques either. They're just people who have learned to recognize valuable stuff from trash. They also know what to do with it. And in this audio interview, you'll get a feel for exactly what that industry's like from an expert. Dave's been making a decent living from his small scrap business since the 1980s, and although the industry has changed a lot since then, there's still plenty of opportunity to be made if you know what to do. And he's going to share it all with you. In this interview, you'll hear a foolproof strategy for getting idle cars you want in your neighborhood for cheap. Sometimes you just got to be patient and on call. Do this one thing to most of the broken lawnmowers people toss out in your area, and Dave says they'll start right up and you can resell them for quick cash and easy money. You'll hear about a couple quick stories that illustrate why Dave's motto of you've just got to go look is the most important saying in business, because things could be much, much better than described or much, much worse. You'll hear the only place you should always grab your flashlight and check for hidden money in any used car, and other surprising valuables people stash away in their cars, then forget about when they sell them. You'll learn a quick start guide to piecing out a junk car, how much parts usually go for, what a core buyer is, and how to find one in your area, and a cost-effective look at whether or not this is even worth it anymore. You'll hear the shocking truth about the U.S. steel industry in China, what happened, and what this means for you. You'll hear about Dave's barrel route for getting started today in scrap. He says no one else is doing this, so it's a huge opportunity, and all you really need are a few $3 barrels and a homemade trailer. You'll hear about Dave's small yellow page ad for buying junk cars that did better than most of the full page ones right beside, and a 3-step plan he used to close his deals for cheap. There is a ton of value in what other people consider junk, but because they don't see it, they'll give it to you for nothing or next to nothing, and if you learn to recognize worthwhile stuff from the trash and know where and how to resell it, you'll not only make a good chunk of change for yourself, but you'll also be doing the environment a favor by keeping the landfills from piling up with stuff that doesn't need to be there. It's easier than you probably think, and in this audio interview with Dave, you'll learn all about it. Hi, I'm Michael Sinoff, founder and CEO of HardToFindSeminars.com. For the last 5 years, I've interviewed the world's best business and marketing minds. Along the way, I've created a successful publishing business all from home from my two-car garage. Now my challenge is to build the world's largest free resource for online, downloadable MP3 audio business interviews. I knew I needed a site that contained strategies, solutions, and inside angles to help you live better, to save and make more money, to stay healthier, and to get more out of life. I've learned a lot in the last 5 years, and today I'm going to show you the skills you need to survive.
Let's just roll with the stories, and then we'll get to some of the nuts and bolts.
You can go up to somebody that has a junk car in their yard every week, and they'll get mad at you. That's a valuable car. What do you mean you want me to sell that to you for junk? It'll sit in that yard for 10 years until it rots into the ground. But in their mind, that's a valuable car. Now, one day they're going to wake up and look out the window and go, oh, my God, that thing's junk. And then your phone rings. And, oh, man, you better be ready to go get it that day. Or, you know, within 48 hours anyway. Weird quirk of human psychology, but that's how they do. Dropping into the 64 T-Bird story, I got a call and the guy says, my son and I spent thousands of dollars together on this project, the 64 T-Bird. We rebuilt the engine, transmission, rear end, bearings, everything. He's got to leave the University of Florida here. He's got an apartment and they've got to have that car out of there tomorrow. And he said, now all the tires are flat, and it's been laying there for a year, and it hasn't been started. He said, what can you give me for it? In that era, my top dollar for a junk car was about $40. He said, I'm going to take you on faith that it's good, and I'm going to take a look at it when we get there. But I'll give you the $40, and I'll come get it right now. God, that's great, man. We got to get it out of here. Jump in the wrecker, go down and get there, tow it home. Drain the stale gas out of it, fires right up. He was not lying. All the mechanicals have been gone. You could look and see fresh paint on everything, and somebody who knew what they were doing had done it. My girlfriend detailed the car out, cleaned it up, put some tires on it. We got $2,500 for that thing 2 months later.
Wow. I think you'd get more than that. How long ago was this?
This was in the mid to late 80s. We live in a dirt poor area.
So in that area, there's not too many people sitting on $2,500 in their bank account.
Oh, nobody. As a matter of fact, that was one of the things I always kept about $2,000 where I could put my hands on it in cash. Because people come up to you Saturdays and Sundays and go, man, I got this gun or this whatever. I'll sell it to you for $20. And that's some stuff that was incredibly valuable. And if they knew you did that, you were good.
Had you seen that car, or did he call you because you were already...
He called me.
You were full-fledged scrap business at that time?
Right. I had an ad in the Yellow Pages, and we'll get into that later. But it was a unique ad, and he saw that ad and called me. Now, if I had gone down there 2 or 3 days before and asked them if they wanted to junk that car, they'd go, man, we got thousands of dollars in that thing. We're not going to junk it. We don't care if he's got to be out of this apartment in 3 days. But when it got down to the last day, and that thing had to go... The telephone rings, and away I go.
That's really important, because I can totally relate to this, because people are hoarders, and then they're purgers, right? Hoard and purge. You get into a hoarding mode, then you have so much shit, you want to get rid of it. You want it out of there. You will pay somebody to come take it out of there.
Let me give you another warning story about the scrap business. Me, personally, you get a lot of deals. Well, I'll give you this, really valuable, if you'll get rid of this. Okay, cool. So you take the goodie and you take the junk. Well, you toss the junk off to the side and you go sell the goodie. Do that for about 5 years and you'll be like me. You'll have 3 acres of junk that nobody really wants. When I had to clean that up, it took 2 months of landfill runs. But hey, it was educational. But hoard and purge, woo, baby. And I tell you what, when you do the purge, it's really mentally satisfying to have all that stuff gone. Because I think all that junk occupies some place in your mind that makes you crazy on a subconscious level.
I agree. So on your property where you lived, paint a picture of what your place looked like, what year you started in the scrap metal business, and how you got into it in the first place.
It was about 80, actually, when I got the first flash. I'd been a foreign and exotic car mechanic for years, and I'd had about enough of it. Pulling wrenches is a horrible way to make, hell of a hobby, god-awful way to make a living. And one day, the guy I was working for said, all right, we're getting all these junk cars out of here today, and up rolls Junkyard Slim, who weighs 400 pounds, in his pickup truck with a long trailer on the back and another car, and about 3 or 4 guys to help him. And what they do is they position that trailer up alongside the car, take the other car, run a chain over the trailer, over the car, and tie it around the window post, take off with the car, and it would flip the junker up on the trailer upside down on the roof. He knocked 3 cars up on that trailer and headed for the junkyard in about 20 minutes. And I'm going, hey, look at this. I think I can do that. Well, you know, that had to ferment a little while, but then along about 81, 82, I was in a beautiful situation. I had a piece of land with $100 mortgage payments, make groceries, electric, and phone, and I had it. So I thought, I'm going to go for it. Now, one thing, I was terrified to leave the security working on a job. I'd have done it years earlier, I think, if it hadn't been for that. But when I finally overcame that and jumped into it, I had kind of a stopgap. I was running newspaper routes at night, and that was just enough money to cover the expenses, so I knew, okay, I can do the learning curve. And I did. There's a terrible learning curve.
Were you living on that property?
I was. It was 8 acres way, way, way out in the woods. And now, there were neighbors. You know, these were 8-acre plots. But there were a number of people out in these 8-acre plots. There's some of that famous old Florida real estate from back in the 60s. You know, $100 down, $100 a month, you can live in Florida. Actually, a friend of mine worked in a bank, and she gave me a call one day and says, Dave, you need to become a property owner. I go, what? You know, what? And she says, look, this guy owes $2,500, and he will sign the property, mobile home, everything over to you if he can get his hands on that $2,500. It's yours, and it's got an ancient mortgage at $100 a month. Well, the tax check had just come in, and that was $2,500, coincidentally. And we looked at it. She guided me through it, being a banker. And there I was, owner of my first piece of property. You know what? I've always owned my own almost entirely since then.
At that time, did you know or did you question, well, if I get into this junk business, this is my land, I can put all kinds of crap on it and no one's going to bother me? Did you understand that at that time?
At that time, that would have been legal. It was zoned agricultural, and the ag zoning at that point in time allowed unlimited amounts of scrap on it. It was legal at that point in time, yeah. So then I figure my first thing out, I had two old sedans and a trailer. The local city was doing a big cleanup. We wanted all the junk cars out of here, so I went down to the city council meeting there and told them, hey, I'll get them for you. They got real curious about that and basically signed me on to do it. And they forced people to get rid of them. And this happens a lot. So I kind of lucked into something there right off the top.
What kind of equipment did you need to get started? Did you have a tow truck?
No, one beat-up old Plymouth sedan, one trailer long enough to flip a car up on, and one other old beat-up Chrysler that we used to chain the car and flip it up on the trailer.
So the trailer was like a sturdy flatbed trailer?
Yeah, it was actually an old frame out of a travel trailer. Wasn't even that sturdy. But, you know, it got me started.
Did you have to do a contract with the city? Did they give you money up front?
Nope, they didn't pay me anything. But what they did do is tell the people, it's got to go. We're going to find you. Dave will come get it for you. This is a very small town. A lot of things done on handshake or verbal agreement.
All right, interesting. That got you started. How many cars were you pulling out?
About 10 a week. Well, okay, this was the next phase. At that time, this little town's about 20 miles out of Gainesville. And there was a scrapyard in Gainesville there. And so I just flipped the car in the trailer and headed for Gainesville. Oh, by the way, don't ever do this today, because back then they weren't as tough on Enviro stuff. And if you do that, the oil's going to leak out of the car, and you're going to get in trouble. Sell the cars for a fraction of what you could get in Jacksonville for them, which I knew, and that's what old Junkyard Slim was doing. He'd take that long old trailer, and he'd take it to his house and dump them off. And then he had a big old tree with a block and pulley up in it, and he'd stack the cars on that trailer, and they'd tow them up to Jacksonville and sell them. So one day I go into Gainesville with my one car and the trailer, and the guy there says, ha! He says, I've got you, man. You got to sell your junk to me, and there's nothing else you can do, and I've got you. Oh, talk about motivation.
Why did he say that to you like that?
He was arrogant, man. He was incredibly arrogant. He thought he was the only game in town. And, you know, he looked at what I had and figured, all right, this guy, he's not going to make it up to Jacksonville. I can mess him around.
Hey, it's Michael Senoff here, and I hope you're enjoying this interview with Dave, my scrap metal expert. Listen, if you are, I encourage you to send for Dave's free report called How to Afford to Eat Steak and Lobster Every Night of the Week from the Money You Make Buying, Fixing, and Selling Appliances on Craigslist. It's Dave's simple system for making it from a few extra bucks per day to making a full-time income buying, fixing, and selling appliances on Craigslist and in your local community. The report is totally free. All you need to do is go to www.fixsellcom.com. That's www.fixsellcom.com. Check it out, www.fixsellcom.com. I think you're going to like what he's put together for you. Thanks for listening.
The scrapyard's going to pay you per pound, per car. What are they going to make on the car? What are you expecting to make on your first car?
Back then, he was paying a penny a pound. If I could get him to Jacksonville, they're worth 3 or 4 cents a pound.
Why such a big difference?
It's 80 miles away. And this guy was making a fortune because nobody wants to take that 80-mile ride back and forth, even locally. So he had all the scrap he wanted coming in. He was making a fortune. Because now he's a broker. If he'd been paying 3 or 4 cents a pound, he'd be getting about 6 or 7 cents probably. Most of the brokers make their margin on about 2 or 3 cents a pound. Now, at his level, he has to sell by the semi-load or the train car load. That's the deal with being a broker. You have to have huge quantity. And you have to sit on it a lot of times. And it's a chess game, too, because you can ride the prices out and wait. And sometimes you can do real well, and sometimes you just get killed. It's a chancy business on that level.
What happens to all that steel ultimately?
Okay, two things. If it's a whole car, usually the way they're disposed of now, and it's been this way for a long time, if you can get together 300 cars, you can call in what's called a car crusher. The guy will come in, crush you 300 cars, ship them up there, get the check, and pay you. He'll pay you about half of what you would have made if you hauled them up there yourself. It's a money maker because you really lose it in transportation and time. But you have to have enough financial depth to be able to buy 300, 350 cars and still survive until you can get them in there.
So does he come down with a car crusher?
Yep, it's portable. It's mounted on a semi-trailer. He'll roll in with that car crusher and a couple loaders. His deal also is he gets all the heater cores and everything that are left in the cars, and they'll take the loader and poke the heater cores and the AC cores out of the cars, pile them up, crush the cars. They usually hire some little guy with a semi to haul them to the shredder. We'll get into the shredder in a minute. And off they go. The guy I had was great. I mean, within a week after that last car went out of there, you had a check. In that era, crushing about 300, 350 cars, bring you a $15,000 check.
What about parts from the car? Is there any value in any of the other car?
Now we get over into the other end of scrap. You have tin, number one steel, number two steel, and cast and motor blocks. We'll start with number one. Number one's a quarter inch and over. Number two's an eighth to a quarter, and ten's everything underneath. There's an unprepared category. You can bring them up there, and they'll just give you peanuts for it, and they'll go ahead and cut it down to size. And then there's cast iron, which is brake drums, old radiators, stuff like that. And there's motor blocks, which are obviously motor blocks out of cars. Those are your major categories. And then you have to cut them to a certain size. Like all the one and two steel, you've got to have no bigger than 3 foot by 18 inches is traditional. There's some little outfits, and sometimes you can get paid more cutting some things a different size. I used to deal with a little local foundry here, and I had a deal cutting scrap out of a Georgia Pacific yard, and there was huge, thick plate in there. And for a while, they paid me a lot of money to cut that into 2x2 pieces because that's what fit into their furnace. That worked real well until they tried to rip me off on one load, and that was the end of that.
How long did it take you to get up to that point?
About 3 or 4 years.
All right. What kind of profit could you make? You said you get a check for $15,000. How much of that could you keep if you were up to the point where you had a crusher come in to do 30 cars?
You'd have five of it in the cars and going to get them and stuff. 3 to 5 going to get them, depending on how well you did. And put 10 in your pocket.
Did you do a lot of those?
Yeah, and that's also what started getting me in zoning trouble, too, but we'll get into that later. Yeah, that was steady. I got to the point where I had enough money backed up that I could do that. You know, I could afford to work that way.
All right, so you said here in your notes you average buying and reselling about £1 million a year, mostly steel, to make about $20,000 to $30,000 net yearly on 40 to 60 gross. Okay.
That's when I had it going, when I had the learning curve down, when I was rock and rolling. That was even before the crushing era. If I had a truck and a large trailer that would haul six of the cars of that era, which are, you know, 5 or 6,000 pound cars, up to Jacksonville. And that's what really took me over the top, was being able to take that stuff after that arrogant scrap guy told me, you know, I got you. No, you don't. I'm independent that way. You tell me that, I'll get you. But I built a trailer, had the truck, and started doing the runs to Jacksonville. And the truck was a boom truck. I had an old boom off a pulpwood truck. A friend of mine gave me the winch off the front of his old military deuce and a half. And old car transmission to back the winch up forward and back off the power takeoff. And that thing, you could load the cars and get them up there quick. I turned around about 3 loads a week, 6 cars a load.
Now, you said most of your income was from the steel, but you also made some money off non-ferrous scrap like aluminum and things you could resell as salvage. Just talk a little bit about how you were doing that as well.
Okay. And even small pieces of steel. Yeah, those cars come in. The trunks were full of stuff. You get hanging around auto shops. There's a lot of stock car racers, the whole automotive trade. There's a lot of small pieces of scrap that just end up getting thrown off to the side. So what I'd do is I'd keep barrels that I'd sort them into as I got the stuff. And I would usually save it up until October. Now, I don't know if this is still the case, but the whole metals market used to go on futures. And all the aluminum and the brass and the copper, the futures bids would start in October, and the prices would spike almost every October without fail. I haven't tracked it lately, so I don't know if that's still true. But I just keep filling barrels till we got up to October with brass, copper, aluminum, and then run them come the end of the year. They're getting on towards the end of the year. On the aluminum, the brass, and the copper and the stuff, your categories there, I'm going to suggest if somebody wants to really get a handle on them, get on the net, and there's sites that list the different categories. Very roughly, you need to be able to tell brass from copper. This red and yellow brass, sort them out. Copper, that's wire, pipe, stuff like that. There's different grades. Now, there's clean, which has nothing else on it, no steel on it, wire without any insulation on it. That brings you the most money, but you rarely find it. So you have to kind of sort it by categories. You'd sort the wire, you sort the red and the yellow brass. You'd sort what they call irony, which is any kind of brass, copper, aluminum, any of that that has any iron in it, screws, bolts, nuts. Not worth your time to pull them out, usually. So you just sort them as an irony category. They bring less money, but it's not enough more to clean them, usually, to get it. And every now and then you get something that's worth cleaning, but you can make your value judgment there as you get a little experience.
Let's just roll with the stories.
I got a 64 GTO convertible that was one of those cars and started out mint in the guy's front yard, gradually rotted down. By the time I got it, the floor was gone out of it and the rust was crawling up the sides. But what we had was every single piece of trim on that car was perfect. The top bows were perfect, and the top was still intact. There's probably, even at good prices, $300-$500 worth of parts on that if you were trying to restore one of them and they were in good shape. So I wrote all that up, put it in the bargain paper. Well, the phone starts to ring with collectors. They're going, I know you only gave $40 for that thing. You're going to sell it to me for $100. No, I'm not. I had it in there for like $200 or $300. And there were about three or four of these, and they would pester me and call me and annoy me. And finally, one of them really made me mad one day, caught me, you know, just the wrong mood one day. I said, yeah, okay. I said, I'll sell you the car for $50. Come on out here. Well, I went out, and I had this homemade car crusher. I smashed that thing into the ground. I broke every piece of trim, every top bow. I annihilated the car. And each time any one of those guys called back again, I said, yeah, come on, I'll sell it to you for $50. When they came out there, of course, they had a heart attack because you couldn't find those pieces anywhere. And they were almost crying. I said, I hope you learned something today. Don't be annoying. Don't mess with people. And you really ought to be willing to pay what something's worth when it's a hell of a deal. Little educational moments there, but back to the parts. Okay, your first thing, everywhere are old starters, alternators, water pumps, pieces off cars. Any of that stuff that rebuilds, there are guys running around called core buyers. You need to sort that stuff into barrels by category, starters in one, alternators in another, clutches and stuff like that in another, water pumps in another. If you need to find these guys, the thing to do is find the nearest auto people, factories near you that rebuild auto parts. Call them up and ask them who are the core buyers in your area, because these are little independent guys that, you know, work on their own, the buyers.
They're all over the country, aren't they?
Yeah. Watch for a one-ton truck with a stake body on the back and a mountain of auto parts. It'll usually be a late model truck, almost brand new, because they run a lot of miles. They wear a truck out. That's a core buyer. If you see them, flag them down if you've been doing this. They're your man. And that's your first most lucrative deal. Back then, I don't know what it is now, but they give you $2 to $4 a starter. There were some of them that were worth a lot of money. Ford diesel truck starter, when they first came out with that in the pickup truck, that was a $150 core if you had one of them.
Wow.
Yeah, there's some real bonus features. And, of course, the core guys, they'll tell you what they want. You know, they're looking for those $150 paydays, too, because when he goes up to the factory, he's going to get three for it. You know he is. So he'll tell you what he wants.
So the core buyers are collecting as much scrap in their mind as they can, and where are they going with it?
They go to the rebuilder. The factories or whoever rebuilds alternators, starters. Like, for example, down here in the town of Jasper, Georgia, there's probably 50 to 100 automotive parts rebuilders, motors, transmissions, water pumps. All the core buyers around here deal in Jasper. They run around here, fill up the truck, head for Jasper. It's payday. And that's how it works here. Now, it's different now. A lot of stuff's getting shipped overseas. Another outlet for the actual cut scrap was to run down to Tampa and sell it to brokers on the docks down there. So there may be something like that going on with parts now.
I mean, when you tell me just in that little town there's 50 rebuilders, it just makes me think, how big is this scrap industry?
Oh, scary huge. It's one of the bigger ones in the country. It stays real quiet. It doesn't say much, but it's a monster.
Why do you think it's so quiet?
Well, I laughed when you first contacted me. You said, man, I know you made a fortune in the scrap business. Everybody thinks everybody's making an unfair amount of money in the scrap business. And the more that they notice that, the more they'll cause you problems, which we were going to get into later. That's why people tend to stay pretty quiet about what they're doing, because it just minimizes the problem with people dialing up the IRS and all the federal agents and sicking them on you. I mean, people will do that because they get jealous. They think you're making all this unfair money. They're not able to do that, so by God, they're going to fix you. It's sad, but that's the motivator. We never did finish saying what happened to the cars after the crusher got done with them. The crusher takes them to what's called the shredder. This is a 6,000-horsepower hammer mill that will shred a car into pieces of steel the size of your hand in 30 seconds. It goes down the chute, it goes in the shredder, out the other end comes steel on one conveyor, brass on another conveyor, copper on another conveyor, aluminum on another one, and the big problem, foam rubber. My broker up there, when I was running them into the shredder, told me, Dave, if I had a way to get rid of that foam rubber, if I could just give it away and not pay to dump it, I could pay you twice the money I do.
This shredder sounds like an incredible piece of machine.
By God, the ground shakes when a car goes.
And it separates all that stuff?
Yep. After it comes out of the hammer mill, it goes into all these shaker tables and magnetic rotating drums and stuff. It separates everything. Yep.
Who owns the shredder?
Okay, in my era, it belonged to a company called David Joseph. They had it built right next to the steel mill in Jacksonville, and they had a little captive railroad in there. They'd shred the stuff. The steel would go off the conveyor right into a railroad car and over to the steel mill. They'd ship the other stuff out when they got a truckload of it, and then they had to landfill all the foam rubber.
It would literally shred a car in 30 seconds.
Boom, gone. Right. Every now and then there's something like somebody left a propane tank in one or something like that. I was there one day. They inspect them before they put them in, but every now and then they miss something. There's a pop-off hatch on the top of that thing for just such events. But when that propane tank went off, it blew that hatch up in the air like a 10-ton Frisbee. You talk about people running looking to hide under cars, man.
Did you see that happen?
I did. I was right there next to it. They were unloading my trailer when it blew.
All right. So tell me, what's the problem with the foam? Because there was so much of it from the seats?
Yeah, exactly. But here's the funny part now. So they piled it up in mountains. Now, somebody robbed the local Jiffy store and stashed all the money up under the dash, and nobody had ever known that or caught that. When the car went to the shredder, all the bills would come out with the foam rubber.
Would they come out intact or shredded?
Intact, yes.
You're kidding me.
No, no. So, the mountains were right where you'd wait in line with the trucks to go into the shredder. So every now and then somebody would look up and go, money! And the money would be pouring out on top of the foam rubber. But now we're talking a 50-foot high mountain of foam rubber. Think about trying to climb that. But if you get up there, man, you're going to cash in until the guys in the yard spot you and then they run you off. But, you know, if you're quick, you get up there and get yourself some bills.
Did you see this happen personally?
Oh, two or three times, yeah.
Let's say for every 100 cars that went through that shredder, how many of them do you think had money sitting in there?
They all had change in them, all of them. And as far as a big stash of bills, probably one in 500.
Where does the change come out?
Under the back of the seats. If you ever want to get a soda when you're running around getting junk cars, just rip the seats out. There'll be about $2 or $3 in spare change there. There's actually a separate mechanism in the shredder to sort the change out. It all goes into its own container because that's a lot of money.
Wow, that's crazy.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Let me do one more on the cars, but I got something your people are going to want. In the cars, always, always pull the seats, open the trunks, look under the dash. You'll find the roll of bills, the guns, the change. A lot of them, you'll open the trunk, there'll be tools in there, all kinds of valuable stuff. I had an old retired guy that came and he says, Dave, he said, if you'll let me just get everything out of the cars, I'll go sell it and split it with you. I said, deal. He did it. He'd take it to the local auctions and sell it by the box load. I mean, even clothes and stuff like that would sell.
What would he sell by the box load? All the stuff he found in the cars?
Yeah, like if he found a bunch of clothes. There's a lot of little auctions here, little tiny auction houses that sell the weirdest thing in the world. People actually go to them for entertainment and just buy box lots just to buy them and take them home. Actually, my favorite one was the nudist preacher auction house. This guy was a nudist preacher that ran an auction house. Now, he didn't do the auctions nude. You know, everybody knew the deal. And he was a character, as you might guess. So everybody loved his auctions, man. They'd go there, just buy anything from him.
So this guy approached you. You didn't want to mess with pulling all the stuff out of the trunk. You weren't looking under the dash at that time.
No, I did. I'd look under the dash real quick, and I'd pop the trunk on every one.
Where do you look under the dash? Under the driver's side?
Yeah, get a flashlight, you know, put your legs up over the seat and stick your head up under the steering column there. Look all up in there. Do that on both sides. It'll pay off one in about every 50 to 100. You'll find a gun or some money or something like
that. Have you found guns under there?
Oh, plenty.
And what's the most money you found in there?
Oh, okay, best story there. Chrysler Cordova, rusted to death. I told you about my little crusher I hit the GTO with. I went to smashing the roof in on that, and I looked back and said, man, look at that. There's a whole bunch of flat washers rolling out of the trunk on that thing where all the rust is. So that's cool. I can always use a big flat washer. Go back and get them. Damn, silver dollars.
Oh, my God.
I tore the headliner and everything out of that. There were 10 Chevis Regal bags full of silver dollars.
What the hell? Are you kidding me?
No.
So how many silver dollars were there?
You know, I've forgotten that one a lot.
And where were they? Up in the headliner?
Yep, they were stashed up in the headliner and in the headliner running down the back columns into the trunk. That's why when I knocked the roof in, they went down into the trunk and out the rust on the back fender, and I spotted those few that fell out. Yeah, those are the best flat washers I ever
seen. Oh, my God. That's incredible. All right, you got any other stories like that?
Well, I could have armed a small nation back then with pistols.
Well, what did you do with the guns?
Pretty much junked them. I didn't want to get in that kind of trouble.
I see.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I'd usually disarm them in some way and junk them. But now, when that guy took over doing all that for me for the split, I didn't ask any questions.
You know, so he would go take all the stuff, sell it, and then he'd come back and give you a check. It was just a matter of time. You had your specialty. That was his thing, and he just split it with you.
Time becomes a real issue when you're running at this level. You got to get the cars. You got to get them in, especially if you're trying to beat the clock and get up 300 of them. You got to rock and roll and get them in there. So this guy doing this was great. And the other thing about this guy is he hung out in all the bars. And so if he hears somebody, oh, man, the rear end just went out in my pickup truck, he'd come to me and go, Dave, can I pull the rear end out of that truck? I'd get a $100 bill for it tonight. Go, man, get it. And he'd pull it, and I'd take it to the guy and sell it to him, and we split it. He was a great guy. Well, I missed him, man, when he disappeared.
All right, that's a great story. All right, you want to do Chester's Junkyard?
Yeah, that's a good one, yeah. Chester still runs a junkyard here. He's a great guy.
How long has he had it for?
Since the 60s.
All right, were you doing business with him?
Yeah, yeah. At one phase, when I was saving up cars for the shredder, if I'd run short on money, and he was closer to crushing than I was, he'd buy the cars off me for what the crusher would pay. And I'd do that just to make cash flow. There were three of us that would work together that way to bail the other one out. You know, somebody needed a part, somebody needed help, somebody needed a piece of equipment. No questions asked. You know, go, take it. Do whatever you got to do. And Chester was one of them, man. He was great. He saved me on a couple occasions coming up with a part for the truck that would have put me down for 2 weeks otherwise.
All right, so everyone worked together.
Yeah, well, it's not everybody. Just we had those alliances among the three of us. It was Chester and another guy named Ed, and they're both still in business doing real well.
Hey, it's Michael Senoff here, and I hope you're enjoying this interview with Dave, my scrap metal expert. Listen, if you are, I encourage you to send for Dave's free report called How to Afford to Eat Steak and Lobster Every Night of the Week from the Money You Make Buying, Fixing, and Selling Appliances on Craigslist. It's Dave's simple system for making it from a few extra bucks per day to making a full-time income buying, fixing, and selling appliances on Craigslist and in your local community. The report is totally free. All you need to do is go to www.fixsellcom.com. That's www.fixsellcom.com. Check it out, www.fixsellcom.com. I think you're going to like what he's put together for you. Thanks for listening. All right, so what's the story with his mom's cottage?
He had an old-school junkyard. He's probably 10 acres of stuff just piled to the sky, oil all over the ground. But in the middle of this was a pristine patch of lawn with the white picket fence and the most beautiful little 1920s or 30s craftsman cottage sitting there. Beautiful, all painted up. That was his mom's. And, you know, if you went to see Chester, you'd have to go visit his mom. And inside, it was all nice. He had a shot glass collection that covered probably every wall in the cottage. It was just such a great change. You know, a nasty old junkyard and then pristine cottage.
I could see it right now in my mind's eye.
Now, we've got to get into the guard geese, too. If you have cars sitting around, thieves are going to know they're going to come for them. Chester had a flock of about 40 or 50 geese. Now, he could go in there, and you could go in there with him. But if anybody else went in there, those geese would run you up in the car and hold you there until somebody came and found you. You could die out there if you were too far out. The geese weren't going to let you out.
That's brilliant.
Oh, it is. Geese are nasty. Terrible, man. 40 or 50 of them after you? Oh, no.
So they get to know you if you own them like a pet.
Yeah, if you feed them every day, then they get your respect. Two things, I think. You know, there's different temperaments in animals. He'd feed them. Anyone came after him, he'd wring their neck and eat them.
What are the thieves going to come look for on those cars? I mean, wouldn't have Chester already gone through the trunk under the dash and really looked for the valuable stuff?
Parts are what they steal. Oh, man. One night I towed a beautiful old 442 Oldsmobile, and I had to leave it over where I had all the cars piled up ready to go for the crusher. When I came back the next morning, all the rims and tires, carbon manifold, 4-speed transmission, everything was stripped out of it and gone. They'll work all night to get that stuff, which my answer to that was I started at random nights. I camp out on a hill out there because this is way out in a rural area. I have a .22 rifle that's extremely accurate, and I'm a good shot. So I wait till I get in there, and they got working on them, and I shoot a window out near them. Well, they get up, and they start running, so I'd knock another window out ahead of where they were running and run them back the other way. I'd run them back and forth 5 or 10 minutes, and then I'd let them escape. You know, you do that a few times. They don't go back because they never know if you're up there or not. The only thing these people respect are crazy. Much else. And they think you're a little unbalanced. That's to your benefit.
Okay, what about the antiques you were talking about?
Oh, yeah. This is anywhere. People pile up piles of steel. Farmers here in particular, old farmsteads, when you go through that stuff, it would pay to know what's antique. Even if you suspect something, throw it to the side, and now you can go look it up on eBay and see. But you just get all kinds of incredible old cast iron stuff and just weird tractor part things and old car parts will be laying in there that somebody would just give an arm and a leg to have them, which is why when eBay and Craigslist came along, you know, I was pretty well out of it then, but I was just getting out of it when all of that stuff was starting to pick up speed, so I got to take advantage of it a little. But today, man, ooh. And actually, it was interesting. In the 80s, in that era, there were a bunch of antique dealers from up north that came through and stole a lot of stuff off the old farmstead. There's a lot of old farms here that go back into the 1800s and stuff. And there were piles of stuff like old cane mills, these big iron pots they cook the stuff in, a lot of big, heavy cast stuff that's a very, very valuable antique.
And they just came in and took the stuff?
Stole it, yeah.
Off of the land?
Yep, they just go in there and rip it off and go.
So if you own a bunch of land, you better have it gated.
Yeah, you better have it secured. Yeah, if you have anything valuable on there, at least around here. There's a guy now, he sells vintage building supplies, and they caught him doing that.
Did he go to jail?
Yeah, I believe he's going to be doing a little time over that one. These old houses have even stuff in them like wood that's so fine-grained, it's beautiful. You know, if you tore down that house, you could sell each piece of that wood to make into something decorative, furniture, stuff like that. There is no more wood like that because it was the first cut of all the pine and the oak trees down here. And those things were hundreds of years old when they cut them.
All right, tell me about this story here, number 14, about the weird and valuable things you stumble into, like the video games.
Oh, hey, right place, right time with the right equipment. Rule number one, you got to go look. Okay, this guy calls me up. He's got a mid-sized car. He's 50 miles from me. He says, yeah, I got this car. I need to get rid of it. He said, I know it's a long way. I'll give it to you. So that was just about a toss-up with the fuel it'll take to go get it. I go, yeah, that's fine. I'll come get it. So out I go. I load up the cars. And he looks at my rig. And at this point, I've got a dump truck with an articulated crane on it, a really long trailer. He goes, I got something that I will give to you, which would help you and will help me. And you want to take a look at it? I go, oh, yeah. Off we go into this big old barn. There are those big arcade video games as far as the eye can see.
Whoa.
I go, okay, what's the story here? He said, I owned bars in Miami all my life, and I got tired of the mob and everybody else ringing me out for money. He said, so I started buying my own video games, pinball machines, stuff like that. He said, these are all the ones that broke, and I just throw them in the barn here and never fix them. You know, I bring them up here when I came out of Miami, and I just throw them in the barn. He said, and now I want my barn back. He said, if you will come out here and get these damn things, I will give them to you. I go, hey, you're on, bud.
How long ago was this?
It's early 90s.
All right, what were you thinking? What was your plan in your mind?
All right, here comes the plan. I knew right away what I was going to do with them. First, I got them home and got them in my barn.
How many were there?
There were 40 or 50 of them. And 3 pinball machines. and got them undercover, you know, where they'd be out of trouble. Now, the Internet was just getting started up now, 93, 94, somewhere in there. And there were forums on there, and there was an arcade game repair forum. I mean, I knew I was going to try and sell them, but this is actually my first online sale now that we mention it. I was thinking, maybe I could fix these things, because the guy said, most of them, the power supply is just bad. Throw a power supply in them, they'll run. So I thought, well, let me see what's involved there. So I started looking for a forum to learn about that. Well, I found one, and it was really good, and there were a lot of people in it. And I thought, wait a minute, why fix them? I bet these guys will buy them. So I put up my own auction, and I said, hey, guys, here's what I got. Here's the list. I'm going to have an auction for the next 10 days. He said, you guys can bid. I said, we'll start at $500. And whoever offers me the most money and agrees to come and get them within a month and get them out of here, they're yours. It got up to $1,000. The guy was in New Mexico. He was a college student to fix the things on the side as a hobby deal. He rented the biggest U-Haul you could rent, came on down and loaded them up. And he said, you know, he said, the reason I really wanted to do this myself, he said, I wanted to have a Southern experience. You got it, bud. So we took him out for a day doing junk, took him to the barbecue pits, all that kind of stuff.
So you were online in the early days. What were you on, CompuServe, AOL, or what?
Oh, yeah, it was a little local network that was tapped in on the bulletin boards and stuff like that. Yeah, I was lucky. My sister had a big consulting business in Seattle, and I was out there from 90 to 94, and she forced me in 1990 to go learn computers. She was already running her whole business digitally on two little old Amstrad computers she'd gotten from, like, FedEx on, you know, send us $200, we'll send you an Amstrad computer. You know, tiny, tiny, still typing in DOS commands and stuff like that. So, yeah, I've been on it since, like, 1990.
That's great. All right, let's do Dave's 10 golden rules for getting into the buying and selling of scrap.
Well, there's really only two. The first one's you got to go look. If I hadn't gone to look at that car that guy called me with the video machines, it never would have happened. Now, remember the T-Bird story, the 64 T-Bird, you know, with the engines rebuilt, transmission rebuilt? Everybody called you with a junk car and said, man, that car runs great. You got to give me more money than that. And you get there and be up under the tree with mushrooms growing out of the roof. I said, hey, that's what I do with all my good running cars. But anyway, you got to go look and see what it is.
I got to tell you this. I got a guy in my neighborhood. He's probably 10 houses up, and I was with my son, and we were just cruising around on bikes, and we saw this guy who's an old guy, and I'm telling you, he's got a Corvette sitting under a car cover that he was going to do something with his son, and it's just still sitting there. What would you suggest I do if I wanted to see if I could buy that thing off of him? Do you think it would work today?
It would be the same thing. You would go talk to him, and he would tell you how that thing is so absolutely priceless, he will never part with it in his life. But just stay friendly with him. Don't even mention the car again. Just stop by. Talk to him about Corvettes. Talk about anything but that car. And just mention casually, well, you know, if you ever have to get rid of it, you know, give me a call. Talk to me. Maybe we can do something. One day maybe the zoning people will get on him, or, you know, neighbors will turn him in. That thing's got to go. And he'll look at it and go, damn it, I'm never going to do anything with it. And he'll call Michael.
Oh, my God.
You really got to finesse it with the individuals. Now, a business that's got junk, you can walk right in there and it'll be yes or no. But the individuals, well, as we say, that scrap has to be aged like a fine wine, or it can leave for the junkyard.
I like that. All right, back to rule number one. You got to get off your ass and go look.
No matter what it is, sounds like crap, go look, right?
Because you never know what else you're going to find there.
Never know, right. That 64 T-Bird, that sounded like every other guy that called up that was just lying. But you got to go look, because every now and then you get that 64 T-Bird.
And if he's purging one thing, he's in a purge mood, he's purging other stuff.
Oh, yes. See, here we're a big student town. So this is end of semester. You want to talk about a good time to go dumpster diving? Yeah. Oh, yeah. End of semester in a college town, they just throw everything away. Most of the kids can afford to go to college. Their parents have actually spoiled them. They'll just buy them the stereos and the furniture and this and that. They literally throw it in the dumpster when they leave the school.
Have you done some dumpster diving?
Oh, always. Oh, ever since I was a kid. Man. Worst thing in the world they ever do is they started to lock them up so you couldn't get the good stuff. Walmart, man, they used to throw all the stuff in there when they figured out people were diving in there and get it.
Give me two dumpster diving finds you did.
Oh, Lord, let's think.
It could go way back. Any one memorable thing. Come on, you see yourself in that dumpster. It's dirty, but under that bag of food, what'd you find?
Working stereos, valuable stereos, TVs. Appliances were probably the most valuable thing. I mean, I've been doing scrap since I was 16. You know, back in that era, they'd have junk night. And you go out and you grab the tube TVs and all the gas mowers they put out by the curb. the tube TVs. You pull all the tubes out and go down. We're talking early 60s now. Down the tube tester, test them, buy the tubes, put them in, or the on-off switch, fire the TV up, sell it. Same thing, lawnmower, stale gas, almost always. Clean the gas out, clean the carb out, fire it up, sell it.
Hey, you'll hear on my most recent Craigslist, one of the stories is my wife was going to the store. She called me, says, Mike, there's some guy who's got a lawnmower on the side of the street. I walk up with my son and my mother-in-law, and she's like shaking her head, like, what the hell do you want with this lawnmower? And I wheel it back to the house. I put it on Craigslist. I never even bothered to get it started. The guy said it worked, and I had one guy come out, and he's like, well, does it start? And I go, well, let's give it a try. And I couldn't get the thing started, and then he passed on it, and then finally another guy called and bought it for $50.
There you go.
So stale gas could be a problem.
Always with lawnmowers. That's the whole reason people junk them. The gas is stale.
Because I was wondering why the hell this thing wasn't starting.
That's why. Especially the new gas. I mean, it's good for a month, and that's it. If they're not putting fuel conditioner in there to keep it from going bad, it'll go bad.
So people are dumping their lawnmowers because they think they're broken, but it's got stale gas.
Right. A lot of them, you put fresh gas in them and they'll fire right up. And then worst case scenario, you'll have to pull the carb off and clean it out. Or if you don't know how to do it, have somebody that does do it. It'll probably crank right up and go. First, make sure the crankshaft didn't bend or anything like that. You know, look at the blade.
This goes not just for old lawnmowers. This could be any gas-related issue.
Anything that runs on gas. Particularly now, this new gas is terrible.
Very interesting. Okay, so appliances, stereos.
KLH stereo, top of the line, turntable, amp. Speakers in a dumpster.
You know how much that stuff is worth now, these old vintage stereos?
Oh, my God, I know. I picked a KLH amp off the top of a trash can coming through town about a year ago. It didn't even work, and it went for like $250 on eBay.
What if someone doesn't have a big piece of land and space is a real issue? That's one of my problems.
Okay, do you have a place you could put a trailer or two? You could probably rent a place to put a trailer or two. I mean, even the mini storage yards, it's pretty cheap if you're just going to keep something outside.
Now, what do you mean a trailer? What kind of trailer?
Yeah, I'm getting at that. Most of the zoning laws that will give you trouble for scrap metal, you are exempt from the zoning regulation as long as that scrap is up on a trailer. So if you had your little operation real well organized with a bunch of barrels on a trailer, there's nothing the zoning people can say. It's also great that you're portable. Well, we'll get to rule number two, don't move it twice. But if you get something that's a lot of little pieces, you can just pull the trailer out there and sort it right there on the spot. Aluminum, iron aluminum, a couple pieces of steel in here, throw it right into barrels. And then when you're ready, you know, you just head on down to the scrapyard with the trailer.
How big of a trailer?
As big as you can find a place to park it.
Is it a trailer that you can walk into?
No, a little flatbed trailer. I don't know about there, but around here, everybody used to sell them. They're a single or double axle flatbed trailer, about 16 foot long, 8 or 9 foot wide, mostly used to haul cars on it. You used to be able to buy them $500 to $800. They're up to about $900 now. Or here now, there's a lot of just homemade trailers, which is great for this. As long as it'll limp around town, great. You know, you go pick it up for $100. I don't know if it's the same there.
So it only has two wheels, like maybe two
and
two.
Yeah, single axle will do fine, you know, if the trailer doesn't get too big. You know, you'll get a feel for it when you start piling the weight on it. You know, if you're bending the springs over backwards and the tires are bowed out, hell, that's a little too much.
All right, good advice. Rule number two, what is it?
Don't move it twice.
What does that mean?
Now, that seems obvious. Well, I'm not going to move it twice. Oh, yeah, watch what you do. All right, we just talk about the trailer. Go out there, put it right in the barrels. The normal way is go get the stuff, bring it home, throw it on the ground, sort it in the barrels when you get around to it. Whoops, pile's getting pretty big. I'm busy. Whoops, pile's getting bigger. Oh, damn. Now I've got to go out there for a whole day and sort that stuff into the barrels. Had you taken the barrels out there to begin with and thrown them in there, you'd be ready to go. That's just one illustration. But if you watch your operation, you will catch yourself time and time again moving it twice.
All right. How do you sort the scrap?
What I'm going to recommend now, you're doing small scale, is I'm going to go for stuff that don't have to cut or process or any of that, into barrels, 55-gallon drums. Most junkyards will sell them to you about $2 a shot. If you're near a port anywhere, there's always excess barrels, drums, stuff like that. You want the steel 55-gallon drum, no top on it. Usually you pick them up $2 to $3 at the wholesalers near the ports, scrapyards, stuff like that. There's always some business in town that's going through a lot of barrels, and the junkyards will have them and usually save them up because people buy them. Just make sure you ask what's in them and decide if it's something you want to swill out of the barrel. I got 20 barrels that were full of concentrated hot pepper ones. You couldn't go near them once you got the lid off.
Oh, that's hilarious.
That's when you outsource.
Do you have to keep your barrels dry? I mean, you say no caps.
Now, as a matter of fact, punch holes in the bottom so the rain drains through.
Oh, that's a good idea. And so the rain isn't going to hurt the value of the scrap. And who cares if the steel rusts, right?
Right, not an issue. The only thing is if you have something that has value is what it is, it may need to stay out of the rain. But if it's something that's a chunk of cast iron that's a valuable old antique, it's probably already rusty.
We didn't finish about get the trailer, and where could I put the trailer? Let's say you didn't have the land, but you had a trailer. Where would you go to put the trailer?
I'd hit up everybody I knew and see if they had a spot. You'd be surprised how many people have a little place out in the country or something like that. When I got in trouble here with all the politicians and they changed my zoning, I had a friend that had a 600-acre farm. And they asked her, Peggy, can I move this out there? And I said, it's free range on parts. Take all you want, anything you need. She goes, yeah, you betcha. Because she'd do a lot of work on her own vehicles, and her boyfriend was a mechanic. So that was hog heaven for them, and that worked really well. It was about a year or two before anybody figured out what was going there because it was so far out in the wilderness.
You've got some tips, like referrals and other tricks to get scrap. What's some good ways to find?
Most of your competition in this are felons who can't find employment otherwise. Hey, it's cool, they're working. You know, that's good. Most of them have attitude big time. So when they go in to get scrap from somebody, they'll get the scrap, and they'll steal anything else that's not bolted down in there. I mean, this is just a regular occurrence. That's why people are afraid of and hate scrap haulers and why you get so much heat from politicians and stuff a lot of times to these guys.
So they'll go in and steal other property other than the scrap?
Yeah. Well, all right, there's this one guy, farmer gave him this mountain of old farm equipment to cut up, right? And the farmer said, now I'm going to bring my brand new disc out there. I just bought it. I'm going to come out here and cut a fire line around this pile so you don't light the field on fire. So he did that, dropped the disc, and took off.
What is a disc?
It's a farm tool that has a bunch of discs that you can drag over the ground. It's like kind of a plow that has rotating discs for the plow part. And he cut a fire line around the scrap pile for this guy. This guy, after he loaded the pile out, he actually cut that man's brand new disc. This is a $4,000 tool. He cut that thing up and loaded it on his truck and took off out of it.
Oh, my God.
And this happens every day, and these guys do this. So if you show up, you don't steal things, you're nice to them, and you always carry a notebook and say, what are you looking for? What do you need? What can I do for you if I find it? And by God, if you get one, give them a call. And they'll tell their buddies, you know, Dave, he didn't steal a damn thing when he was out here. Look what he got me, man. I've been looking for this thing for a year. He'll tell all his 250 buddies that, and your phone will start ringing.
The important thing is the scrap business is an ongoing. It's not just one time. They'll have you back and over and over again.
Most people, it is, if you steal their stuff or you're nasty to them, it is a one-time deal. But, see, you can really stand out. Well, you know, it's like customer service today. All these big stores treat their customers like dirt. What are you, nuts? You know, it's the same deal. They'll get you back, and they'll tell their buddies. Well, you know the old thing. If you go to a funeral, there's going to be 250 people there. Everybody knows 200-and-some people. And they're going to tell them, man, Dave was cool. He came in here, he did this, and then he called me later. Great. You're good. You're gold. Word of mouth, you can't beat that for a referral. I got huge on that.
All right, let's talk about the Yellow Page ad.
This is before I knew anything about marketing, hadn't a clue, and I nailed the USP on this one. Okay, you know, everybody in there, big Yellow Page ads, tell this, that, all I put in there, little ad, cash for junk, I come to you, junk cars and scrap metal, recorded message, my name, phone number, because a lot of people know me locally. I was never around anyway, so on the answering machine, you know, hey, I'm Dave. I said, here's what I'm doing this week. You got a junk car? Okay, little one like a Toyota, that's $10. Little bigger, mid-size, 20 to 30. Some big old tank you got out there, I'll give you 30 or 40 bucks for it. I said, piles of scrap, I'm going to have to come out and look at them. We'll talk about it then. So go ahead and leave me your phone number, and I'll get back to you just as quick as I get back in here. And I think the things that really hit it there were the I come to you and the phone message. Because somebody's got some junk, and they want to get rid of it, and they've heard all the stories about their buddies getting ripped off. I think that really helped them have enough comfort to call you. And then when you're friendly and upbeat and outgoing on the message, they say, oh, okay. And, you know, I usually get a pretty good response when I call them back. other than those terminally miserable people, you know, the one in 100.
Yeah, that's good. It's non-threatening. You sound like a super nice guy, and you told them exactly what's going to happen.
Well,
we talked a lot about the scrap business, but we don't really want to get into a full-time scrap business today.
No, you don't. You do not. No, 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 no.
All right, so for all the people listening thinking that you may be encouraging them to get into the scrap business, that's not really what this is about. It's about finding value in what people view as junk. But let's talk about why we don't want to be in the scrap business. What are some of the problems and some of the risks? Operating problems, for example.
Okay. If you're going to go on that level, you need heavy hauling and lifting equipment. If you're going to be serious about it, you got to move about 1 million pounds a year. That means a lot of cars, and that means serious equipment. Now, being a mechanic, I cobbled stuff together or welded it together myself. But, you know, for the average person, that's really almost not doable. The second one is the jealousy factor we talk about, where people will bust you out just to be mean. And my example for me, even when I was small time, I got inspected by every environmental agency, local, state, and federal. I got audited by the IRS, and they all came out, and they laughed when they got out there. And after they got done, they said, these people are calling us up and writing letters to us telling me that you've got all these mountains of toxic waste leaking out in the road and that you're driving Cadillacs and got this big pile of money. And they get out there and see how I was living. The IRS guy was great, actually. He laughed. He got out of the car laughing. I said, hey, this may be an all right audit. This may be one of the few. And he was cool once he realized basically they'd been hoodwinked. And all I did was look through all the books. You know, I always kept that up real well. He was cool. But constantly, you waste days of time dealing with bureaucrats. The other thing is, well, I don't know, we just got some kind of a prize for being really corrupt in Florida here. We got a county commissioner here that was going to set his nephew up in the junk business. So he did everything to every junk hauler, every junkyard he could think of to put him out of business and set his nephew up. And it was a good old boy network here, and it still is. He was powerful. He had a lot of success on that.
What did he do to you guys to inhibit you?
Change your zoning and get the enviro people on you.
So when he changed your zoning, how did you react to that? What did you do?
Nothing you can do.
Did that put you out of business?
No, that's when I moved on to my friend's 600 acres there.
Oh, got you. Okay, what else did they try and do?
That's about the worst of it. Once again, they put the zoning people on you constantly. And this was not nice. The zoning guy would come out and say, you're going to clean this up and stop in 2 weeks or I'm going to put you in jail for a long time. And they weren't kidding. I mean, it was a whole good old boy network, the judges, the officials, the politicians. Now, I got to laugh because the guy that did that here is doing time in federal prison for bribery. See, he was one of the kingpins of crooked. He really was. But, hey, making license plates now. It's a pleasant thought.
All right, you got availability problems.
Right now, they're paying more for scrap. It used to be the people that made the fortunes of scrap made them in wartime. That was when they were paying just silly money for scrap. Right now, we've got wartime kind of prices for scrap. I mean, this is more money than scrap's ever gone for. And, well, what's happening, dude, it's all being exported to China, unfortunately, but that's another issue. And so what you have is everybody and their brother knows this, and they're out grabbing everything they can. So you can't buy junk cars for 10, 20, 30, 40 bucks anymore. The bottom of the ceiling on that's $200. And that's for a tiny little car, and you better have a junkyard be selling a lot of parts at a high dollar to make that work. So there goes cars, other than the ones you maybe you could drag one off to somebody stripped out or something like that. But those high scrap prices, you know, if you were to go into full-time business doing this, you couldn't get the volume right now.
Plus, the Cash for Junkers program, didn't that take out?
Oh, or how about the charities? Oh, give us your junk car. We'll give you a write-off.
Aren't they making a fortune?
They're making a killing on that, yes.
So they're really kind of in the junk business, those guys.
Yeah, they are. Well, what they do is they'll have somebody that's a mechanic, and they'll get a bunch of them running, and they'll do the 64 T-Bird routine. They'll turn them into a few $1,000 if they can get them running. And then the rest of them go to the junkyard for big money, yeah. Yeah, they didn't pay a dime for them.
So scrap prices today are high. People are paying big money for scrap.
Yeah, way up there.
And much of the scrap is going over to China?
Oh, yeah, almost all of them.
Really?
Yeah, we're in bad shape industrially and financially. We destroyed our economy, basically. Well, see, that's when I had to quit back in 98. It was the beginning of this nonsense. That year, they let the Asian countries dump all their steel in our market for pennies on the dollar. It finished wiping out the steel industry. My broker, the guy that had the shredder and everything up in Jacksonville, called me up and says, Dave, he said, it's over. He said, I can't even buy it from you anymore because the mill won't buy it from me. He said, we're done.
Man. So the Asian countries dumped all their scrap steel?
No, finished steel.
Oh, so all their finished steel.
Yep.
So if I'm buying steel, there's a good chance it's all coming from Asia?
Oh, yeah, a great majority of it now is, yeah. And it has been ever since then because of that.
Did the prices go down?
Yeah, it dragged our prices down here. But, see, they let them come in and get a huge market advantage. It was, you know, a loss leader deal. They dumped all that steel, and they let them do it long enough, it wiped out the steel industry, and then they had it nailed.
So we have no steel industry anymore.
We do. Hey, we're Americans, man.
We coming back?
Well, we came up with a mini mill, little tiny steel mill that just does one specific thing, rebar. There's one here, closet-made factory. There's one they do entire runs just with the steel shelves there for the closet-mades. They coat with rubber.
The mini mill is kind of helping America with their steel production.
It's all that's left of our steel industry, but, man, they're kicking it. They can do it. It actually saved that particular yard that had that investment in the big shredder and everything. They were able to go quite a few more years. They shut it down eventually because that mill didn't have enough capacity to match what they were doing. But, yes, the mini mills have saved us, definitely.
Okay, so all the scrap is going overseas. Everyone's still in the business. Much of it's going overseas.
Right, right, huge majority of it. The media and the politicians will make hay on you if they can. You know, like if you push that with the zoning people and they put you in jail, they'd have put a big old story up in the paper about that. It'd have been wrong and you'd have seemed evil and this, that, and the other thing. The local media here is a little biased. They're in on the good old boy network.
Tell me what one of the biggest problems and reasons why we shouldn't have a scrap business as a full-time living.
Mostly, I don't think you're going to be able to get enough material. The price of running a big truck now is prohibitive. I don't know how these independent truckers, well, they're not making it. They're just not. I used to really rough check my numbers. If I put half of what I had going on in my pocket, I was good. You couldn't even come close to that today with your transportation costs, cost of fuel, trucks, tires, stuff like that.
What would you do today if you wanted to get back into it?
Here we go. I got this one thing going real well right before the boom came down in 98. It's called the barrel route. I went and got a bunch of 55-gallon drums, put a sticker on each one, like the ad that was in Yellow Pages we were talking about, and then I started going to all the automotive shops or anybody that would make any kind of scrap and said, hey, how about I throw these barrels out here and you throw all your scrap in it? Right about that time, all the dumpster people were starting to get on them about throwing greasy parts in the dumpsters and stuff like that. I said, I'll solve your environmental problem here. You just throw them in here, call me when they're full, and I'll come and get them.
How'd you get this idea? Have you seen someone do this?
Nope. This occurred to me that this would work. Oh, boy, like gangbusters. I had a Sears Auto Center that would fill 10 drums with brake drums and aluminum little pieces and stuff like that every 3 days.
When did you start doing this?
This was mid to late 90s, and there's still nobody doing it. I was the only one then, and I haven't seen it since. There's a huge opportunity for a small business there.
How many barrels did you get?
Probably had about 500 of them out there at that point. But I didn't do that all at once. You know, I went and got 100 barrels, $2 a shot, a couple hundred dollars, got them out there.
And people were real receptive?
Yeah, oh, man.
Because
yeah.
If they dump crap in the dumpster, they're going to get fined.
Yeah, the dumpster guys will cut them off. They will. Which reminds me, this is another thing. I mean, you need to knock holes in the bottom of the barrels. You need to keep a tarp over them, too. You don't want the water washing through them and the grease and oil coming off them and on the ground. But now, in this case, I had to move them twice because I had so many going on. I would go out with that dump truck with the articulated crane on it, whole back full of barrels, whole trailer full of barrels, drop empties, load full, drop empty, load full. I'm about 20 miles out of Gainesville, so I'd run through Gainesville and hit them all. Oh, let me get this in here before I forget. When they call, you got to roll, particularly something like Sears that's just filling them up. Man, if you're not there right away, they'll throw you out of there. In the end, I sold the scrap business to some guys, and they got slack about showing up. They lost all the good accounts on the barrel.
Oh, really?
Oh, we'll get there in a couple of days. Yeah, you will, and take the barrels with you when you come.
So you'd bring all your barrels back to your place, and you'd sort it?
Right, which is moving it twice, but at that volume, I had no choice. I always worked solo, you know, other than, like, cottage industry stuff, like the guy that would clean out the trunks and sell parts for me. You can't do employees. It's too expensive.
All right, so were you making some good change doing that?
Yeah, oh, man. Yeah. Now, that's one other thing, too. You always want to kind of keep half an eye out. You know, you need to have a little space to pull this off, really. A lot of what you're going to get is stuff that can't go as scrap, like shock absorbers off cars. It's good to either have a little car there to throw them all in, or have a deal with somebody that has a junkyard. Hey, can I throw these shocks in your car? The crusher doesn't care. You know, they can go through the shredder and the crusher. The shocks are fine that way. You know, you can work out some kind of trade there. But, yeah, I bring them home, sort them, and then when I have basically a dump truck full, I dump them in the dump truck and go.
That's called your barrel route.
Right, right. And you could do that small scale with a hand truck, a low trailer, so you're not dragging the barrels up too steep a ramp, or even a pickup truck, you know, anything like that. You know, Harbor Freight has those little hydraulic cranes and stuff. McMaster Car is this cool little clamp that'll clamp on the side of a barrel, and you can pick it right up, and then when you let the weight off it, it lets go. It's not inexpensive, but it will save you a lot of work. There's a lot of ways you can move barrels easily without having to have a lot of expensive equipment. You know, I wouldn't want to go any bigger than a pickup truck anymore. If you get 3/4 ton or 1 ton, that'd be cool.
All right, commercial insurance issue.
Okay, this is hugely expensive. Back in the 80s and 90s, it went from $2,500 to $3,000 a year, and I ran it just because I was very visible. This is where everybody has to make their own moral decision and their risk and reward deal, because at a small level like that, you can't really afford it. Mostly everybody will let you go buy if it's just a hobby, but if you get in a wreck and you got a bunch of scrap on there, it's going to give your insurance company a way to wiggle out. But you can't afford the commercial stuff either, so it's catch-22.
Is Sears going to want commercial insurance for your barrel?
No, none of the shops ever asked. They didn't care, because your equipment is never coming anywhere near their stuff. It's out in the parking lot, and the liability for that's on the shopping center or wherever it is. And most of the repair shops, they never even think of it, really. They're just glad to get that stuff out of there.
All right, what's this about this 70% of Florida drivers are uninsured anyway?
Yeah, they're supposed to jerk their license and tags, and they don't. So you have wreck after wreck after wreck where, I don't have any insurance.
How about deals you can do on commission? Are there opportunity that way?
You're going to see things that are like industrial surplus, valuable things that people don't know where to sell them, or maybe what the value is or anything like that. You can make a deal with them and say, hey, I think I might know where I can sell that. Would you give me an option on that for like 6 months and you'll give me 10% of it if I can sell it? Most people go, yeah, man, it's been laying out in the rain all this time. Key points there. You have to lock up the option. You know, 10% is about average. And you have to have a written contract, because if anybody's ever going to do anybody in, they're going to get the broker in it. Now, okay, we should also get into Robert Ringer's book here, which has an excellent thing in it. It's called Winning Through Intimidation, which the title of the book doesn't even match what's going on in there, but I guess it helped it sell. The whole book's about deal making, and anybody that's going to do this kind of stuff as a broker ought to read that, because he mentions three particular types of people and how your deal's going to go down. There's the straight-up guy. He's going to squeeze every penny out of you, but he's honest as the day is long, man. He's going to do what he says he does. He's going to make his money. He's going to get his half. And I'm going to make a subset of that category that you have just your generous people, you know, that just give you stuff. Okay, next person comes in, seems normal, seems like type number one, looks like he's real straight up, going to do the deal. Yeah, okay, good. They will do something that will make you think they're mentally ill in the middle of the deal. But, of course, this will happen at a point in time when it's to their advantage. And then type number three, the guy that comes in tells you, man, I'm the most honest guy, I'm a great guy, I'm wonderful. This guy will screw you. Watch him. And watch his counterpart, the guy that comes to, everybody screws me, man. Everybody takes advantage of me. Or the whiners, they'll get you, too, every time. And this is an abstract on that. If you've got dogs and you have people coming around, if your dogs don't like them, watch them.
This has been a hell of an interview.
Yeah, rock and roll.
What do you want people to learn from your stories about being in the scrap business? What lessons should they take with them after they turn this recording off?
Okay, I want to have a little bit of a learning curve done. I want them to stay small, and I don't want them to put all their eggs in one basket in the junk business. This needs to be an adjunct to something else you're doing, because you're real vulnerable here. Now, you can get blown out of the water and told to stop for, you know, 101 reasons that we went into. But that's life today anyway. You need to have 3, 4, 5 things going on at all times. But this is a cool one. You know, a little side deal, maybe run that barrel route, keep your eyes open, learn what's valuable. Pick up some scrap piles if you're in a place where you see some. Just another way to make a little bit more money as an adjunct to everything else you're doing.
All right. Now, if someone wants to talk to you further and maybe get some more specifics and details, I know you do some consulting for people who want to get into the scrap business. What would be the best way for them to contact you?
Right now, it's going to be email me at dave@davebross.com.
Spell it out.
DAVE at DAVEBROSS.com.
So if someone contacts you by email, what can they expect as far as follow-up and what kind of services can you provide?
Oh, I can keep them out of trouble. I can cut their learning curve down to almost nothing.
Hey, it's Michael Senoff here, and I hope you're enjoying this interview with Dave, my scrap metal expert. Listen, if you are, I encourage you to send for Dave's free report called How to Afford to Eat Steak and Lobster Every Night of the Week from the Money You Make Buying, Fixing, and Selling Appliances on Craigslist. It's Dave's simple system for making it from a few extra bucks per day to making a full-time income buying, fixing, and selling appliances on Craigslist and in your local community. The report is totally free. All you need to do is go to www.fixsellcom.com. That's www.fixsellcom.com. Check it out, www.fixsellcom.com. I think you're going to like what he's put together for you. Thanks for listening.